Whether Monsignor William Lynn stays in prison or gets a new trial is now in the hands of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Lynn was the first Catholic Church official nationwide to be convicted for covering up sexual abuse. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that prosecutors filed papers today arguing against a new trial.
The Philadelphia District Attorney's Office offered sweeping evidence at the trial 4 years ago. 21 instances when Lynn failed to stop priests from abusing kids. But Lynn's attorney says there's just one problem. Nearly all of them were not under Lynn's supervision.
We tried this case for like 36 days. 28 days of it was devoted to these other crimes by these other priests.
Defense attorney Thomas Bergstrom says Lynn shouldn't be the scapegoat for what he says was the church's widespread indifference toward the abuse. Pennsylvania's second highest appeals court agreed and ordered a new trial. But now the DA's office is asking the state Supreme Court to keep the conviction, calling the order for a new trial, quote, embarrassingly unjustified. It's an opinion shared by David Clossy, who runs the Chicago-based Survivors Network of those abused by priests.
We would prefer that a procedural error, like letting in more evidence rather than less, wouldn't necessarily force a new trial.
Clossy says he finds the thought of a new trial disturbing. The conviction needs to stand, he thinks, to deter future molesters and those in charge.
Catholic officials who clearly act selfishly and recklessly and callously and deceitfully are exploiting every conceivable legal maneuver to evade responsibility for horrific crime.
Catholic Church officials didn't return a call asking for comment. As the Supreme Court weighs whether to grant a new trial, Bergstrom points out that Lynn, who's been in prison for more than 2 years, could soon be eligible for parole. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The poisoning of Flint, Michigan's water has made lead a topic of national conversation. But you don't hear much about the lengthy medical treatment needed to get lead out of a person's body. WHYY's Paige Flager introduces us to a New Jersey family who faced that situation when their son was just 1 year old.
For the Degenhart family, the culprit was not tap water, but paint. In the early 2000s, Marianne and Joseph Degenhart were doing rehab work on their house in Collingswood, New Jersey. Like many old homes, the place had a lot of lead paint. They chipped it down from windowsills and walls and cleaned it up very carefully. But despite that, their son Joseph, who was a year old then, was exposed.
I dropped a binky on a piece of lead and I picked it up. And then I put it back into my mouth.
This was in 2003. Joseph is 13 now. After a routine blood test at his pediatrician's office, the Degenharts got a scary phone call. Get to the hospital right away. Joseph had toxic levels of lead. Joseph Sr. remembers the 11-day hospital stay well.
The treatment was like right into the thighs, big needles right into the thighs in the hospital with this chelation medicine, something that actually binds to the lead and then it gets removed to his urine.
Joseph Jr. had to have follow-up treatments for 4 years, which meant more needles.
Which I absolutely hated. It sort of felt unfair to me.
He also had some developmental delays and needed therapy for that, Marianne says.
2 or 3 times a week for an hour or so. And then we also had a speech therapist come out. And after, I'm going to say a year, Joseph was right up to par where he needed to be.
The recent news reports out of Flint have brought back a lot of memories for the Degenharts. Joseph hopes that nobody there has to go through 4 years of treatment like he did. For WHYY News, I'm Paige Flager.
Tuesday marks the next big date on the presidential primary season, with elections in key states including Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Illinois, and Missouri. Let's look ahead with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Let's look ahead, but first let's look back. The consensus at the start of this week was that Hillary Clinton had a fairly clear path to garnering the requisite 2,383 delegates to claim the Democratic nomination. Then rival Bernie Sanders put up a roadblock Tuesday with his win in Michigan, surprising pundits and pollsters. Pundits, well, they're people. Polls, though, are based on statistical science. How do pollsters get tripped up?
Well, that's a good question. You look at Michigan, where most of the polls that were conducted showed Hillary a clear, probable victor. And, of course, she wasn't. Why? Well, I think people who've looked into that say, first of all, it was an open primary, which is very difficult to project because voters in Michigan were able to go in and decide which ballot they wanted on the spur of the moment. They want to vote Republican or Democrat, so a lot of independents were hard to chart, hard to predict what they were going to do. Turnout is a big factor in the Democratic primary this year. Interestingly, we have very, very strong demographic correlates with support for Sanders and Clinton. African-Americans strongly for Clinton, young people strongly for Sanders, as an example. So trying to estimate the relative turnout by all these groups becomes difficult as well, and a shift there can cause problems as well. But I would say overall, primaries are tricky. Most of the pollsters have been involved in it. Actually, have done pretty well in predicting primaries and caucuses so far this year, but it looks like maybe on the Democratic side with Sanders and Clinton, there's a lot of movement among Democratic voters, and those are tough calls.
I have a hunch poll results inform pundits. Do pundits, to any extent, inform pollsters?
They shouldn't. You know, polling, as you mentioned a moment ago, is a science, and pollsters are doing their best to accurately reflect what Americans tell us when we ask questions about a lot of things, including who you're going to vote for. So what pundits are saying or anything that's going on out in the environment shouldn't affect that at all.
Would pollsters say it's a winning strategy for Clinton and Sanders to link their campaign to President Obama?
At this point, yes. We're seeing some fairly interesting movement on the part of Americans' views of Obama, and they're positive. 52% in the middle of this week, Dave, was a three-day average from Obama. That's the highest job approval for that three-day average that we've seen for the president going back to the spring of 2013. Also, last week, his average, which we compute Monday through Sunday, was 50%, and that's the highest weekly average as well that we've seen since we go back to May of 2013. Now, Obama's doing particularly well with Democrats, 87% of whom for the last week say they approve of the job that the president is doing. And with that kind of very, very strong support, it's no riddle why Clinton in particular is attaching herself very strongly to the policies of President Obama.
What are Americans' major concerns this week?
This is almost the same thing that we would have said or did say when you asked me that question last year and the year before, Dave. It's the economy, number one. The thing that varies a little is where dysfunctional government comes in. Right now, it's the second most frequently mentioned problem. At times last year, it was the most frequently mentioned problem. But those are the big two, the economy, a dysfunctional government, and then another variant of economy, jobs. And then below that, Americans say the big problems are immigration and health care. I want to point out one thing that we found, and we just finished asking this question for our March update. We have 5% of Americans who say elections are our biggest problem. So we looked into the verbatims there and say, what were they talking about? And most of those people were talking about Donald Trump. So one out of 20 Americans now, when you say, what's the biggest problem facing America, come back to us and say it is the rise of Donald Trump.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Still ahead, we'll check out a St. Paddy's Day celebration that focuses more on culture than cocktails.
Sober St. Patrick's Day, the organization, is not against drink, it's against the drunk.
It's time to go green when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The University of Delaware MBA supports WHYY. The UD part-time MBA offers busy professionals the opportunity to pursue their education and their careers with flexible online and on-campus options and a variety of specializations. Prospective students can drop in anytime during their upcoming information sessions on Wednesday, March 18th and Wednesday, April 6th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Learn more about the University of Delaware MBA, including information on their national ranking from PayScale at udmba.com.
Art and Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Two Trains Running by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson. The civil rights movement is sweeping across Pittsburgh's Hill District, and Memphis Lee and the regulars at this diner are fighting to hang on to their piece of the pie. A masterpiece about unsung men and women who are anything but ordinary. Two Trains Running is on stage March 10th through April 10th. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or artandtheater.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. As part of our series, First Year, First Generation, we've been following five first-generation college students through their freshman years. This installment focuses on one word, money. and one question. What does a first-generation student do when she finds out she owes more of it than she ever imagined? From the Delaware Desk, Avi Wolfman Arendt reports.
This is my UDSIS account, and I guess we're going to look at my finances.
It's a Friday in mid-January, about halfway through Jackie White's winter break. She's sitting in the darkened living room of her home in Newcastle, Delaware, staring at a number on her laptop screen.
It says that I owe a lot of money, $7,984.45, to be exact.
Sometime around Christmas, White got a letter from the University of Delaware telling her she owed that amount, in full. Otherwise, she wouldn't be able to register for spring semester classes.
So what was your reaction when you got that letter?
I cried. I cried.
Literal tears?
Yes, actual literal tears. But what else is new? It's college. Like, everybody cries.
Her mom works two jobs to keep the family afloat. Her family recently scrounged up enough money to buy her a laptop so she doesn't have to write papers on her phone. White does not have $7,984.45.
I'm scared because I don't know what to do, and like, I've been boosted like all this time. They're like, yeah, you're going to go to college when you grow up, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, well, I did what you told me to. Now what am I supposed to do? And I feel lost.
White is grasping for contingency plans. Maybe she could take a semester off and work. Maybe she could drop out and go to beauty school. But the panic, it's palpable. The next semester begins in 3 weeks.
Can you try to log in again? We're trying to see if we can get you into UDSIS.
1 week later, I'm crowded into a small office with White, her aunt Jessica, and Imani Powell, a University of Delaware student advisor. They're hoping Powell will say this was all a terrible mistake.
All right, so let's see. My finances, cause I think that's where we can kind of get a sense of.
Here we go, right in the.
There it is.
The number, $7,984.45, hasn't budged.
It looked like the payments are kind of at this stage. They're due. It's due in full.
Mm-hmm.
For the next hour, Powell guides White through her options. She doesn't have many. At one point, he leaves to get his boss. It feels remarkably similar to the moment when a nurse fetches a doctor to break bad news, and the patient is left lingering in the waiting room. Aunt Jessica steps in to offer a pep talk.
You have to find what your focus is. Mine is making sure my kids are safe, healthy, happy, fed, loved, all the stuff. You got to figure out what that is. I hope that you know that that's you. I hope you know that that's your future. And I don't know that you have been told that in those plain terms. You are worth this.
White nods and musters a determined look, but it's clear. She doesn't know how to fix this. A 2009 report sponsored by the Gates Foundation found the number one reason college students drop out is to make more money. Their number two reason? They couldn't afford tuition and fees. For first-generation college students who may struggle just to feel they fit in, money problems can make all that moot. Fortunately for Jackie White, this story ends well.
She's going back to school tomorrow!
Yeah, I'm getting out! I'm out!
It's a Saturday in early February, one day before the new semester begins. Jackie and her mother, Alexis White, are at the kitchen table.
She's going back to school.
No, Jackie didn't win the lottery or find $8,000 under her mattress. But her mom had a hunch that the bill was a mistake and emailed a financial aid expert at the university.
And that's why I said, it's got to be wrong that you owe $8,000. I bet you your scholarship hasn't kicked in. Because technically, you're not going because technically you haven't registered. And of course, that was the case.
Jackie did owe about $1,400 because it hadn't been paid and she hadn't registered for second semester classes. Some of her financial aid was withheld. If she could pay off the $1,400, it would unlock the second semester scholarship and wipe out the rest of the balance. The financial advisor told Jackie's mom to apply for something called a Parent Plus loan. If Alexis was denied, it would qualify Jackie to take out more federal loans to cover the $1,400 balance. Alexis put in an application.
48 seconds later, we're giving high fives because I was denied.
Yeah, for we're like, yes, we're born!
Yes!
In 24 hours, a problem that had hung over the family for almost a month disappeared. But it still left them uneasy. As Jackie moped around the house for most of winter break and talked of things like beauty school, Alexis had flashbacks.
What is she going to do? Because then it's like, we were 19. I was 20 years old when I got pregnant with her. So it was just like, no, we're not repeating this cycle. Like, no.
The episode was a reminder of just how fragile Jackie White's time in college truly is. She now knows 20 years of her family's hard work to get her here can get wiped out in an instant. From the Delaware desk, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
No need to wait until Thursday, March 17th to wear green ribbons and shamrocks. The Philadelphia St. Patrick's Day Parade kicks off Sunday at noon at 16th and JFK Boulevard, and then, when it concludes, the heritage and spirit of the day, minus the spirits, will be celebrated right here at WHYY's Civic Space. Helping to establish sober St. Patrick's Day and joining me for a preview is Westchester native Catherine Ball-Weir. She chairs the Delaware Valley branch of CULTUS. It's a Dublin, Ireland-based worldwide cultural organization. Catherine, welcome to NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And this is the second annual Sober St. Patrick's Day celebration in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, although it has been in New York for several years.
Since 2012.
That's right.
Now, Catherine, I confess it's as much as I could do to pronounce CULTUS, but I understand that's just a shortened version of the entire group's name.
It is. CULTUS Kiltory Éireann is the name of the group. It is, as you mentioned, a Dublin-based Irish cultural organization, and there are many branches all over the world, but particularly in Ireland, of course, and in the United States. And in New York, there's a very, very active group, as you might imagine. And in Philadelphia, there is as well, because we have a large Irish population here. And so we try to bring the best of Irish culture to the community. We're involved in Irish music and dance and language. And putting together Sober St. Patrick's Day is one way that we can offer the community a little slice of the wonderful Irish heritage without the overindulgence that some people come to expect from St. Patrick's Day.
In fact, in researching for this conversation, I learned that for many decades, drinking was banned in public spaces during St. Paddy's Day.
That's exactly right. So if you were celebrating in Ireland, you wouldn't expect to be drinking. Sober St. Patrick's Day, the organization, is not against drink. It's against the drunk. The idea is to celebrate respectfully and in a fashion that is going to be appropriate for families.
What are some of the highlights?
Well, we're going to have some really fabulous musicians. Headlining the day is the group The Yanks, really popular Irish traditional band.
String quartet?
A quartet, but not exactly a string quartet. Dylan Foley, however, does play fiddle, and he is well known as world champion Irish fiddler, an all-Ireland champion.
Irish dance will be well represented as well.
Indeed. So we have two kinds of Irish dancing. We have both the step dancing. So we have a couple of Irish dance schools who will be joining us. And then there's also a ceilidh dance. And the ceilidh dance is suitable for everyone. It's group dancing. And it doesn't matter if you've never tried it. There will be lots of opportunities to give it a whirl. And if you just want to sit back and enjoy watching, that's fine too.
Now, I understand you're not the only one in your family with a love of all things Irish, and with that, let's bring in your son, Alex. Alex, is that a violin, a fiddle? Does it matter?
They're actually the same instruments. They're just given different names for the kind of music that you're playing. So when you play something like classical music, it's always called a violin. But when you go into different kinds of styles of music, such as Irish music, it's usually called a fiddle.
How would you define that genre specifically, Irish fiddle music?
Irish fiddle music is mainly based upon dance music. Most of it is very lively, although there is also a couple of styles of tunes that are not necessarily made to have dancers perform to them.
Alex, I'd love to hear you in performance. What are you prepared to play?
Right now, I'm going to play two tunes, two jigs, actually. The first one that I'll be playing is called Hole in the Bucket, and the one that I'll be playing into is Jimmy Ward's. ¶¶
That's Alex Weir performing Hole in the Bucket and Jimmy Ward's. His mom, Catherine Ball Weir, chairs the Delaware Valley branch of Cultus. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had production assistance this week from Brett Rader. Our intern is Jared Whalen. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Stanishevsky. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.